You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Frank, let me get to it. He hit me. He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war hero. He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate to tell you.
Donald Trump struggling for fresh minorities to insult starts rather audaciously on former prisoners of war. Will his dismissal of Senator John McCain's service record prove a step too far, even for people who weren't laughing out loud at the very thought of him winning the nomination? My guests Isabel Hilton and James Boyes will discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the latest victim of China's anti-corruption drive, or is Ling Jihua really a victim of a political purge? The new development bank launched by the BRICS economy. Who are its likeliest customers? And Barack Obama prepares to visit his ancestral homeland of Kenya as president for the first time. What has taken him so long? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue, and James Boyes, historian and author of Clinton's Grand Strategy. Welcome both back to the show. And we are going to start tonight with the Republican Party's ongoing attempt to reenact the closing scene of Blazing Saddles, or possibly Reservoir Dogs. Specifically, we are looking at the ceaselessly self-replenishing horn of plenty that is the campaign of Donald Trump, whose latest Hearts and Minds initiative has been to disparage the service record of Senator John McCain, who once spent 5 years and change as a prisoner of war after being shot down over Hanoi, while the riskiest thing Trump has ever done is gone outside on a windy day. Nevertheless, recent polls have the big goose as the front runner for the GOP nomination. James, I don't know.
Where to begin, right?
Well, exactly. Where to begin? Is this going to be... And I say this with mixed feelings, sure, because obviously his whole campaign is absolutely risible, but it is hugely entertaining. Will this sink him?
No. Oh. In a nutshell. Sorry.
Well, that's good. Happy and yet not.
That's great, because
that
it keeps him bubbling along. I think that there's been an awful lot of press written, particularly here in Europe, in the last couple of days, saying this is it, this is the end of Trump, it's one step too far, et cetera, et cetera. I think that... what we're perhaps missing in that analysis is the idea that there is a section of American society that he appeals to who actually love this. They don't like John McCain, who has never been a darling of the Republican Party, it must be said. They believe that he has made an awful lot of his military record. I am not agreeing with that, by the way. And therefore, Donald Trump comes along and is seen to be speaking truth to power. And there is a degree to which that is very popular within a rather anti-intellectual element within the Republican Party.
I would tend towards the view, as I'm sure you would as well, that a man who spends 5 years as a prisoner of war is entitled to make as much of his military record as he subsequently feels like. Isabel, James mentioned there, and it's clearly the case, 24% of registered Republicans are all go Trump as opposed to the recent poll. As far as it's possible to tell, who in the wide world of sports are these people?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that the polls are pretty volatile, but I absolutely agree with James. You have to think of him, he won't be sunk by an outrageous remark. That's what brings people back. He's the Jeremy Clarkson of the presidential campaign. You know, it's the notion that here is someone so outrageous that you can't help watching him. Now, there are people, of course, who think that that is a genuine political position. There are other people who just, you know, say to hell with all of them, and he's a breath of fresh air. And we've seen this in American politics before. I mean, Sarah Palin was hardly noted for her keen grasp of international affairs. She said some pretty outrageous things. You know, there have always been wildcard candidates in U.S. elections, and there's always been a section of the population that goes for them because they are kind of disillusioned with formal politics. And people like this seem to represent a kind of rupture with formal politics, which they think is on their side.
There haven't been this many wildcard candidates with this much money, though. James, is there, I guess to ask the obvious and faintly terrifying question, is there the remotest danger he could actually win this thing?
No. Simple as that. We've got what's interesting now is Governor Kasich has just thrown his hat in the ring this afternoon. So there's now 16.
Well, who hasn't?
16. Well, exactly. I understand that somewhere there is a Republican who isn't running for the presidency this year. But the advantage, of course, that Donald Trump has got is his billions of dollars and his capacity to generate column inches and airtime across the world just by making these outrageous statements. If he was talking policy, we wouldn't be discussing him. End of story.
True enough.
I think by the time we get around to Iowa and New Hampshire, however, you're going to see the emergence of more credible candidates within the Republican Party. You know, and the poll suggests there that it's going to come down to really Jeb Bush or Scott Walker at this point.
Isabel, by the time that happens, and I suspect and indeed hope James is right, and eventually the grown-ups will take charge of the race, but is the Republican Party brand or the image damaged in the meantime, the longer Trump carries on?
I suppose it's not assisted, but you have to, again, to go back to that tradition of, and there have been rich men before. Ross Perot was a billionaire who also spoke directly to the people, and some of these have had no party at all, so they spoke directly to the people. What's interesting about Trump is that he's not engaging with the party exactly. He's not engaging with the machine. He's not talking to the local power holders. He's really counting on his celebrity and his money to generate publicity, plus the things he says and the fact that he is already a kind of on television a lot, to generate that kind of attention. But that isn't really serious political momentum. And I think it is very volatile. I mean, you've watched the other candidates' ratings go up and down quite dramatically. And I think when it comes to the hardcore, you know, campaigning and the hardcore machine politics, he's just not going to get a look in.
Isabel rightly raises the spectre of Ross Perot. And Ross Perot is the most horrendous historical analogy that the Republican Party can generate at this point. The party, the leadership are having to be very, very careful at this point. They've come under severe pressure to try and criticize Donald Trump. The great threat for the GOP moving forward in terms of the election is not him getting the nomination. It's Donald Trump deciding, I've got all this money, I don't need you, I can run as an independent. And if he does that and enters the polls come November 9, 2016, he will siphon off huge swathes of support for whoever the Republican Party nomination is and hand the presidency to the Democratic nominee that year, who then might well be Hillary Clinton, in an exact rerun of what happened in 1992 and 1996.
And he'll do what Ralph Nader did to Al Gore.
Exactly, yeah, absolutely. Siphon off the report just enough, or maybe in great sways, to hand the presidency to the Democratic Party.
I just wanted to follow up the point you made earlier about the size of the Republican field. Mm-hmm. And I did some fairly hardcore electoral maths on this earlier. By my reckoning, the scary thing about this is that Donald Trump, I think I'm right in saying, is only the seventh most ridiculous figure in the contest. I put him behind, on sheer preposterousness, I put him behind Huckabee, Santorum, Perry, Carson, Paul, and Jindal, maybe just ahead of Graham. So my question is, has the Republican Party learnt nothing from the last presidential election? Because it now obliges their nominees to spend 2 years pretending to be insane in order to win the primaries, and by the time they do that, they've alienated every centre-ground voter in the country.
It's fascinating. I'd love to know what your rubric for discerning craziness is, quite frankly. However, I mean, that could take a while to explain. There's no doubt about it that the great problem you have for both parties is that it's a two-stage process. The primary area, which we're going to start in January, necessitates going to the extreme of your party, either left or to the right, to try to get the nomination. And the longer that process goes on, the more people who are campaigning, usually the further to the right you have to go to try and get the nomination and draw the crazies in. It happens on the left as well, it must be noted. Then you've got this mad rush to the centre to try and demonstrate that you are a centrist all-round American to try and get the presidency. And it is a contradictory nature. And this is one of the reasons that the Democrats have actually got a head start this time, because, you know, there are only three or four candidates of whom Hillary is, quite frankly, leagues ahead in terms of most of the polling, which is one of the reasons she's got the head start. She can start basically focusing upon herself, whilst the Republicans are too busy basically rounding the wagons and shooting one another, which is exactly what's happening right now.
Well, we will have to move along somewhat regretfully to a less entertaining but probably more important example of party infighting, which is the one occurring inside the Chinese Communist Party. The anti-corruption crusade, which is supposed to be a cornerstone of Xi Jinping's presidency, but which occasionally resembles resembles a complicated contraption intended to dispatch political opponents, has scalped another bigwig, this time Ling Jihua, a one-time aide to former President Hu Jintao. Isabel, what is your read on what's taking place here? Did Mr. Ling actually have his fingers in the till, as they're suggesting, among other things, or has he upset somebody he probably shouldn't have?
I think both of those are true. You know, when a mafia leader goes down, you don't ask if he was a criminal. You ask how he lost his protection. And there are, you know, there is a certain useful read across to this. This is a complicated and very interesting anti-corruption campaign. An anti-corruption campaign is standard kit for any incoming Chinese administration because it allows you to get rid of all the people that the previous administration has put in place to thwart your policy. But it doesn't usually go this far. And there have been a kind of set of tacit rules which are to do with trying to institutionalize a transition, an orderly transition in Chinese politics. And one of those rules is that you don't go for your immediate predecessor, because it frankly lessens the motivation of anyone to step down. What you want is for your leaders, after two terms, to be able to step down peacefully, go into retirement, and a new leader comes up. If a leader thinks that he's going to be got at by the incoming president, then he's not going to give way. So there are a number of consequences that might occur as a result of the thoroughgoing anti-corruption campaign that Xi Jinping has inaugurated, which has gone further, higher, you know, deeper.
Indeed so, just to follow that, because some proper godfathers have been clobbered this time around. I mean, this is a month after Zhao Yongkang was jailed for life, the man who some people said was analogous to, you know, China's Dick Cheney figure.
J. Edgar Hoover plus, you know, yeah.
But an extraordinarily important and previously powerful man.
Yeah, but a man who had files on everyone, and you wouldn't want him out there, you know.
But what is it, does this look to you like it is, that there is any kind of logic to this, or has it reached the stage of being the kind of the apparatus which is now just consuming even the people who built it?
Well, there's always a danger that those processes become that, but it certainly starts off with the logic. You have Xi Jinping, who is faced with a moment of transition for the Chinese economy, plus how do you maintain the Communist Party in power, you know, forever? What are the discontents with the Communist Party? Corruption is clearly a big one. So you have a big demonstration effect of an anti-corruption campaign. At the same time, if you want to transform the Chinese economy, you've got to take down some big resistance. And some of that resistance is in state-owned enterprises, in the oil business, in energy. Zhou Yongkang was a key figure in that. So you go for people who have big patronage networks, like Zhou Yongkang, or like Ling Jihua, and he's touching on Hu Jintao's patronage network here. It's quite dangerous. You know, he might get to a point where people say, you have just gone too far, and there's a knock on the door in the middle of the night. But so far, the first thing he did was to consolidate all the security services under his direct personal command, so that if somebody does want to take him out, they're going to have to do it, you know, outside those security services which he controls. So it's interesting territory. The other slightly less benign effect of this is that it's kind of paralyzed the bureaucracy, because nobody knows what's allowed anymore. Nobody knows, you know, when the next shoe is going to drop. Nobody knows if the people that they are associated with might come under the spotlight. What he isn't doing is having an institutional systemic clear up. He hasn't set up a neutral anti-corruption commission the way Hong Kong did. He hasn't done it through the legal system. It's all within the party, and these people are being picked mostly for political reasons.
James, Isabel talks there about what she said, a demonstration effect, and there have been suggestions that Ling Jihua's card was marked after his son died in a Ferrari crash in 2012, which is possibly a curious means of demise for the son of a public servant. But what do you think...
Two semi-naked ladies.
Yes. Well, indeed so, but... What do you think this is actually in practice going to end up demonstrating to officials, that they should be less crooked or they should be more discreet?
Probably a bit of both, I would imagine, quite frankly. I mean, I'm quite happy to yield to Isabel on this. He's quite clearly knows an awful lot about China more than I do. But this idea, I think, that we have seen this purge, effectively, of previous office holders in China, is something which I think should enable us to look upon our own political system here, both in the United Kingdom and further afield in the United States, with some degree of pride. I mean, no one's, I think, worried too much that David Cameron's going to start purging the Liberal Democratic Party, quite frankly, because there'd be nobody left.
which is a great
what would be the point?
Absolutely. Well, you know, that would be really like rubbing salt in the wound, I think, quite frankly. But and of course, we're letting, you know, the Labour Party are tearing themselves apart at the point. So we do have our own way of purging our own political enemies in this country, which I think is far more cynical and scary.
Isabel, the Chinese people, and I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of all 1.5 billion of them, but would they tend at this point, when as news of this stuff does emerge, once you learn to read between the lines of official Chinese media, would they perceive it as, you know, would the general reaction be, I guess I'm asking, hooray, corruption is being cleaned up, or that, yeah, okay, fine, this is score settling?
I think that they're always delighted when one of these guys goes down because, you know, they have egregious privilege and fabulous wealth. But I don't think that they're suffering from the illusion that this is going to clean up the party in any kind of profound or permanent way. And if it were, the people, the ordinary civilians who don't really get a look in this kind of thing except to post pictures of people with watches they shouldn't be able to afford on social media. But those people who, for instance, called for officials to declare their assets, which you might think in an anti-corruption drive would be a rather good move, their feet didn't touch the ground, you know. So they know that this is like, you know, they're the grass that's being trampled as the elephants fight. You know, they quite like it, as I say, when a big figure goes down. But they have no illusions that this changes the system.
Okay, final thought from you on this, James. American foreign policy being your particular specialty. To those in the State Department, in the intelligence services who regard China professionally, how nervous does this kind of thing make them, sort of infighting within the Communist Party? Because obviously the Communist Party's big thing is stability, and I'm pretty sure I'm right in suspecting that where China's concerned, the US State Department's got no particular problem with that either.
No, absolutely not. I mean, for all the idea that, you know, you wouldn't think the State Department would be advocating a Communist Party, it does maintain the status quo, quite frankly. And what, you know, the last thing that an American administration wants is any lack of stability in China. Nobody quite knows exactly where it is that China is going or what its policies are going to be moving forward. We've heard, obviously, Hillary Clinton famously talking about the Pacific pivot, for example, and that's something I think that will be carried on if she's become president in 2016. The idea, I think, that somehow you can try and forecast what's going to happen there is far too problematic. But nobody wants a radical change there, least of all the American State Department.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Miller, along with Isabel Hilton and James Boyce. Coming up next, a new development bank for less developed countries and Obama's first presidential visit to his father's homeland. Why has he left it so late?
We should have breakfast together and lunch and coffee and cake and a forced beer or even an Aperol Spritz at sunset. And we know just the perfect spot. Come and join us at our London cafe that's just around the corner from our Midori HQ and also close to the Monocle shop. While you have a great flat white made with all press coffee, you'll no doubt bump into one of our team and get to hear all the latest from the Monocle world. You can also pick up the latest issue of the magazine. Oh, and we also have space for hosting private lunches and events too. Join us at 18 Chiltern Street in London and also our outpost in the Hankyu Men's Department Store in Tokyo. We look forward to seeing you.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and James Boyes. Now, the so-called BRICS group of developing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, has existed as a formal or informal concept since the first months of this century and seems to have spent much of the time since then figuring out if these five countries could really work on much more than a snappy acronym. But the alliance is now to be given real shape and real clout with the establishment of the New Development Bank. The NDB will begin with a fund of $50 billion due to double over the next couple of years, and it will make its first loans in 2016. Isabel, first of all, how will this be significantly different from the IMF and or the World Bank?
Remains to be seen. Interestingly, Nick Stern and Joe Stiglitz have claimed credit for this idea. They claim they thought it up in 2011 at the World Economic Forum, where, of course, all great ideas come from.
Which they will continue to do until the whole thing goes calamitously wrong, and then they will say it was nothing to do with us. At all.
Trump's fault.
Right. But they thought it up as a way of recycling, good recycling of surpluses in emerging economies. So, of course, the key country that has the big surplus is China. And instead of this sloshing around in dangerous ways around the world financial system, to put it into development is a good idea. The second spur was the fact that the IMF and the World Bank have not reformed themselves to accommodate the new global economic realities. So you have countries that between them have 25-27% of the global economy with almost no votes in those institutions. And the attempts to reform those institutions were stymied, as so many things are, by the US Congress. So what's interesting about it will be, I mean, you can see it's in China's interest because China now wishes to build infrastructure all over the place because it has a lot of surplus capacity it needs to employ. That needs financing. You know, quite neat if this bank could help to finance the building of infrastructure in Central Asia, you know, the One Belt, One Road stuff in Latin America for countries that can't otherwise afford it. It'll need to be run, I think that probably in terms of its rules, it'll be less different than you imagine, because it's going to have to go to the market. The market is going to impose certain conditions, certain disciplines, so it's not going to be that different. They say it'll be speedier. But in general terms, I think finance for infrastructure development is not a bad thing. The fact is that most of the countries have borrowed more from the World Bank than they've put into this bank, and it is relatively small, but it will grow.
$100 billion, James, it's a lot of money. It's nearly enough to bail out Greece for about 18 months on current rates.
Until next Tuesday.
In fact, would India and China in particular be seeing this as a power play, as a means of extending their influence throughout Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you put this together with the idea that not so long ago the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank was launched, you know, you can start to see a discernible attempt here to say, well, look, you know, the West has had it nice and easy for too long. It's got the IMF, it's got the World Bank. You know, they're perceived as being instruments of the West and the United States in particular. You know, they're based over there. So, you know, if you look at the idea that China is clearly the coming market at this point, it's the second largest economy in the world. It's in their political and economic interest to have these entities as a discernible alternative. There'll be political and economic elements to all of this. Isabel rightly points out the idea of funding development, in particular in Africa, which we're going to be talking about shortly, in South America, in Central Asia. You know, these are areas which perhaps the United States has had opportunities to expand into, hasn't done so, and will end up ruining the day, I think, at this rate.
Isabel, you said it probably in practice won't be much different from the IMF or the World Bank, but might there be a different approach to business in terms of dealing with its customers? Might it take a more forgiving view, for example, of developing economies?
That has been said about Chinese development lending to date. But I would enter a slight note of caution. China's not the only player, though it is the biggest one. It won't actually get the chairmanship of this bank till 2021. The first chairman is an Indian. They will then rotate until China's turn. China has also, I think, slightly ruining the largesse that it has extended to Venezuela, for instance, where it's going to lose a lot of money, and indeed to Zimbabwe. So I think that as, you know, China's kind of approach to overseas investment and development lending matures, you're going to see, and certainly its partners will insist, that there is conditionality, that actually there are rules. Brazil's experience of trying to set up its own development bank a few years ago, kind of also very bound by the rules because it had to go to the market for the money.
Okay, well, finally tonight, this weekend, Barack Obama will make his first presidential visit to his father's birthplace. Or if you're one of the 24% of Republicans apparently leaning towards Donald Trump, this weekend, Barack Obama will go home to check in with his handlers and plot the next stage of their covert plan to incorporate America into the Islamic State. But either way, why wait until now to visit Kenya? James, it's not his first visit to Africa.
True.
And I think a lot of people probably would have expected that the obvious first place for him to go would have been to his ancestral mm-hmm. homeland, which he rather pointedly has avoided
yes.
up until now. Why wait?
I think, in all honesty, this is a president who has not wanted to be seen as the black president. He didn't campaign as the black candidate. He hasn't wanted to be seen to be the African-American president. I think we've seen that both domestically in mm-hmm. terms of his inability to quite know how to handle the domestic ongoing racial tensions which we've seen across the land. And I think that's also been borne out in terms of his foreign policy. He doesn't know quite how to handle Africa. He knows what he doesn't want to be. He doesn't want to be tarred with that identified in that manner. I have to say, I think that once he leaves office, he'll do something similar to Jimmy Carter. I think he'll spend far more time in terms of the developmental elements and some of those softer elements which many people thought he would do as president. It's not his first trip to South Africa. To Africa, he's been to a variety of countries there beforehand. The interesting thing to remember, of course, though, is that let's put this into contrast with George W. Bush, who, when he visited Africa at the end of his term in office, was lauded across the land for his very notable work in terms of aid reduction, some of the I think $15 billion worth of anti-AIDS and the medicine that was used to prevent and to address that dreadful disease across the continent. Something which Barack Obama cannot point to. Perhaps the only thing he can point to is a whole host of new drone sites which have been put in place across the north of the African continent, and of course to the rather flawed revolution in Tunisia, if we're counting that as part of the African continent.
It is a curious irony of Barack Obama's presidency, as you quite correctly point out, the first black president, the first African-American president, mm-hmm. but because of both of those things, felt like he couldn't really get too far out in front mm-hmm. on issues like this. I did look it up. This will be his fifth visit to sub-Saharan yep. Africa. George W. Bush made 10. Isabel Hilton, what does that tell us? Has he just been... Is it just the fact that he is who he is which has made him slightly awkward and uncomfortable where Africa's concerned, or has he just had other priorities?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. If you look at Obama's foreign policy, what we're seeing now is a kind of interesting rush, if you like, to highly significant moves. So Cuba, Iran, perhaps Africa. He now you have a sense here of a man who's liberated from the constraints of what might be said in his next election campaign and is kind of going for it. But it has been a long period of neglect. Certainly in Africa, I think it's late. The Chinese, of course, are all over Africa. Much bigger investment, much bigger trade, and whatever he does, he's going to look as though he's playing a little bit of catch up. There's going to be, everyone is going to say, why weren't you here before?
There was extraordinary expectation prior to his election. I think about a month before his election in 2008, I was in Addis Ababa. And on every flat surface, there were posters of Barack Obama. There were big piles of bootleg copies of his books available on every street corner. He was a noticeably more frequent presence in the city than Haile Selassie. James, is Africa as a continent entitled to feel a bit disappointed about Barack Obama's presidency?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you would have thought that it would be a no-brainer, quite frankly, that here you have a son of the continent assuming the presidency of the United States at a time in which, calls for greater investment in Africa are coming in. As Isabel rightly points out, China is basically making great inroads, quite literally, into the continent. You would have thought a time and a place that Barack Obama could turn around and say, listen, we in the United States have to get serious about Africa. Bill Clinton, to be fair, had tried it. His national security advisor, Tony Lake, was one of the foremost members of the national security team to have a high regard for Africa. They tried to implement African conferences during his time in office, hadn't really got very, very far. You would have thought with Barack Obama, there'd be a natural inclination to move in that direction. And I think, to be honest, he's been so cautious with regard to not wanting to be seen to be the African-American president that he has steadfastly not done so. That does not mean that his foreign policy credentials are not sound. As Isabel rightly points out, there's been an awful lot of very quiet diplomacy going on. We're seeing the results of that at this point. And in addition to the trip to Africa, we could perhaps see a trip to Saigon before the end of his presidency. John Kerry's off to Havana very, very soon. And who knows, maybe even in Tehran, he said optimistically.
We will have to leave it there. James Boyes and Isabel Hilton, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode, which was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Melkin Chartroglian, and Eugenia Elanskaya. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Aisha Spears will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. Josh Fennett follows that at 1900 hours with Section D. At 2200, it's the Monocle Daily, tonight hosted by Dom Reynolds and Emma Nelson. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time, as always, but for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.